Session entitled Black American Literature, A Vision for Truth. And my name's Paul Olson. And we'll start by a little puzzle. And if it's a pretty old puzzle. So if you've seen it, don't say anything. And if you haven't seen it, then have fun trying to figure this out. Everybody see this angle here? On the back of one of those papers that I just gave you, or just in your head, whatever you want to do here, see if you can connect all of these dots with four straight lines, and don't lift your pencil off the paper. Okay, nine dots set up in a square, and then you want to see if you can connect all nine dots with four straight lines without lifting your pencil off the paper. If anybody hasn't done it before, does it? Let me know. How many people have seen this before? Well, quite a few. But you can't remember? Charlie, have your hand out for the test.
I just remember I'm in the wrong section.
Yeah. I can get mixed up too far. Okay. Yeah. Anybody get it that hadn't done it before? Did anybody remember it? Okay, where are my chocolate? Tell me what to do.
Start from the upper corner.
Start here?
Yeah, go straight across and you gotta go outside the squares.
Oh, okay.
All the way out. And then you make an angle line coming back down to connect two. Yeah, that back one. Then go straight up. Then go kitty corner down.
Pretty clever, isn't it? It was a puzzle. What the heck does that have to do with African American literature?
You have to see things differently.
Exactly. Most of us, I have never met someone, and I've pulled this puzzle off in classes for many, many years. I've never met someone who could do it. And it says something, in a way it's kind of funny, but in a way it's kind of sad. I couldn't do it either. It's kind of sad that we just can't imagine life outside the boundaries. We can't imagine doing something differently, that we can break rules. And the way that fits, and we'll see that in the excerpts of literature today, the way that fits history is we've got a whole lot of people who had a whole lot of rules, like, you know, when the white man comes, you give him your seat on the bus. And Rosa Parks saw here and said, no, I don't think I'll do that today. And completed the puzzle, you know. But it takes a real special kind of vision, and there are all kinds of people. And my profession, my life, is a big part of it anyway, is getting involved with these people who are writers, who are poets and novelists and autobiographers, who are people of vision. And that's the sense of this title today, African American Literature, A Vision for Truth. We're going to look at writers who have a vision that says, that brings questions to things as they are, that brings questions to the way we perceive our whole, first of all, our whole society, and then in a bigger context, and if you're a good writer, you've got to get outside of your society, in a bigger context, how we see the universe, how we see God, and how God relates to us. Writers, I think, good writers do that.
You know, there's a spiritual solution to that problem, too.
Go ahead.
Put two X's, I mean, an X through the diagonal ones, and a cross through the center ones.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
You come out and do it.
I don't know if anybody's going to find
you come out and do it.
Amusing or not, but...
I do it. I see what you said.
Like this.
You can't lift the pencil off paper, though.
Well, that's true.
You're cheap.
but they're all connected to the center.
Oh, sure. That's nice. Then we got one, two, three, four lines. Four lines. It's a great puzzle, but you cheated.
Yeah, but it's very spiritual, though.
Yeah. I'm going to remember that. Use that in my class. Okay. Well, now, after we get this one figured out, now, who can figure out a spiritual connection? That'll be the next question for you. Okay, that's good. That's good. Let me start off with an excerpt from a wonderful book that, for whatever it's worth to you, changed my life when I was in college. It's written by a Swedish sociologist. And the Swede could change my life. It's big time, you know, that's a challenge, right? Okay. And the guy's name is Peter Berger, and the book is called The Precarious Vision. And just one little paragraph of that is that he's a Christian sociologist, and he comes at life, which he calls a precarious vision, just on, okay. And he looks at life as a social scientist. And here's what he says about that. On one hand, the social scientific perspective leads to an oppressive sense of bondage. What he means, and we'll illustrate that specifically, concretely, through the artists that we're going to look at. But the social scientific perspective leads to an oppressive sense of bondage is that we're so much a product of those defining forces that shape us, of our environment, of our history, of our culture, of our parents. I mean, and that's a sense of bondage in that how free am I really? And one of my favorite illustrations to be concrete with what he means by that is I did graduate work at the University of Oregon, and before I was married, I lived in the graduate dormitory. And we always had every summer what they called Asian or Polynesian days. And you went through the cafeteria lines and they served Polynesian food. And I remember this one particular celebration. I went through, and here's strawberries and pineapple and all this wonderful fruit. And we came to the main staple, and it was poi, P-O-I. Now, poi looks like a big bowl of brown mud, a gray mud to me. It tasted like a big bowl of gray mud to me. And the Asian people that were there, because Oregon's on the coast and they had a lot of Asians there, they just thought, wow, this is great. And then they ate the poi, and I went across the street to McDonald's and had a hamburger after I ate my food. But what dawned on me in that is that even the physical taste buds are determined by something that's not within my free will. Had I grown up in a different culture, poi would have been, wow, what's a great day today. Instead, I go over and have the all-American, you know, hamburger, right? Listen to Berger again. On one hand, the social scientific perspective leads to an oppressive sense of bondage. That is, we are products of our environment. On the other hand, I love this one, it leads to the liberating feeling that the social world is far more tenuous than had previously seemed to be the case. It's a paradox. I want to give you two words that we will consider as we listen to these artists talk to us. Artificial and absolute. On the one hand, it leads to a liberating feeling that the social world is far more tenuous than it previously seemed to be the case. The liberating feeling comes from the valid insight that the social world is an artificial universe whose laws are conventions, rules of the game that have been agreed upon, but that also can be broken and against which one can cheat. It seems to me that American authors, all good writers, most especially Black American authors, make great distinction between the artificial universe and the absolute universe. Just for example, what are some absolute laws? There aren't too many. Here's one.
Gravity.
Yeah. No matter how many times I do this, I'm always going to go down, every time. Can't violate that law.
Did you say universe?
Death and taxes.
Yeah. Almost taxes. But death for sure.
Well, you can't make a four-sided triangle and a three-sided rectangle.
You're a math teacher.
Oh, my God.
Right. Okay, we get the sense of that. Now, name some social laws that are so powerful that they almost seem absolute. I read a story, and it's one of the reasons that it's part of the black community in Chicago was thinking of filing a lawsuit against Nike. You've got to have your $90 Nike shoes, right?
Yeah.
This great, great basketball player, I mean, one of the few kids you could spot at 16 that says, this guy is going to be a pro. On the way home from school one day, two kids stopped to rob him, and he said, we want your shoes. He sat down to take them off, and he said, no, I'm not going to give you, these are my Nikes. And they killed him. And the argument in the black community is that Nike has put such a great job of subliminal and other kinds of advertising and pressure on these kids that you got to have your Nikes. And on it goes. You can think of it. Well, think of some others. I mean, that's a real...
Barbie dolls.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're white Barbie dolls, and they come out with black Barbie dolls, but they don't look like...
Real
black women. They look like white women with dark skin.
Yeah.
And the whole, you know, that whole system, I think is connected to what we were talking about yesterday, with having to own things.
Yeah.
And not only the possession, but owning the beauty and the strength as well.
Very good. Good. Here's Maya Angelou. I referred to this yesterday, but it's powerful. She's a little girl. The dress I wore was lavender taffeta, and each time I breathed, it rustled. And now that I was sucking in air to breathe out shame, it sounded like crepe paper. And I'm betting I'm getting my glasses on. I know, and it's absolute.
It's absolute.
Do I need glasses, doctor? No, but you will when you're 40. Baloney. That is not an artificial, crepe paper on the back of hearses. As I'd watched Mama put ruffles on the hem and cute little tucks around the waist, I knew that once I put it on, it looked like a movie star. It was silk, and that made up for the awful color. I was going to look like one of the sweet little white girls who were everybody's dream of what was right with the world. Hanging softly over the black Singer sewing machine. Then I've skipped some stuff. Wouldn't all those people, she's on her way to a special celebration, wouldn't all those people be surprised when one day I woke up out of my black ugly dream and my real hair, which was long and blonde, would take the place of a kinky mass that Mama wouldn't let me straighten. My light blue eyes were going to hypnotize them after all the things they said about my daddy must have been a Chinaman. I thought they meant made out of china like a cup because my eyes were so small and squinty. Then they would understand why I had never picked up a southern accent or spoke the common slang, and why I had to be forced to eat pig's tails and snouts, because I was really white, and because a cruel fairy stepmother who was understandably jealous of my beauty had turned me into a too big Negro girl with nappy black hair, broad feet, and a space between her teeth that would hold a number two pencil. It's the opening of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. How does that fit, just that excerpt, this concept? You see, right? It's clear. What's beautiful? Well, when we're adults, we begin to distinguish between these two. When you're a kid, boy, the pressure is tremendous. Kelly Chapman's session yesterday on gangs and the fundamental origins of them have to do partly with this concept. Who am I? This, and it's defined by somebody else. Well, it's a broad picture of American black life if you one looks at black literature. And I think that's important to get across, and it's really hard to get across in a 40-minute session, even if you have six of them. but this is going to kind of celebrate that blackness too. Not all black writers point to oppression, though oppression and the history of slavery is always a part of that existence. But here's a different kind of look. This is by what at one time people called the radical black poet, Nikki Giovanni. It's called Let's Take a Nap. You'll get the sense of why I read it in a second. Well, as soon as you hear it. Almost every day, after my lunch, after my milk, after I go, the speaker is a baby. Almost every day, after my lunch, after my milk, after I go to the potty, and Teddy and Piggy, my green turtles, have been fed, and I can't think of anything to do quick enough, Mommy says, come on, chocolate drop, because she thinks I don't remember what she wants. Let's take a nap. Just because I'm a little feller don't mean I'm dumb. And then she takes off my shoes and pants and hops me into her big bed, and I have to climb on her chest, be tossed in the air, get tickled under my chin, hear this little piggy three times, and get the bottom of my feet kissed at least twice before I put her to sleep. That's an incredible, to me, in the context of African-American black literature, that's an incredible poem that just suggests, I mean, I'm not trying to read something into that, I'm just putting it in a context. In the context of slavery, that poem, and historical slavery and all this legacy, that poem is about freedom, and it's about love, and it's about transcending that kind of history. That's a very rare thing, and I'm suggesting that the poet, the artist, has the vision to say, I am not going to always have to struggle with these absolutes that are carried on in my history. And sometimes I'm just going to talk about a poem that's about, that anybody could write, right? That's part of this. Then you have a handout that I want to read just parts of.
But don't you have to get to a certain point? You have to get past being obsessed with the trauma of the past before you can get through to that. And it's a long struggle.
Yeah. It's a long struggle. And past, I would change, for the sense of Nikki Giovanni, if I can speak to that, but I would change the word obsessed to an awareness. And here's Nikki Giovanni in some of her other poetry. Nigger, can you kill? Can you kill? Nigger, can you kill? Hunk, can you kill? Can you kill a Jew? Can you? And on and on. It's just a driving, pulsating poem. It's power about changing the society, changing one's mind. I have that somewhere. That we could look at it if you choose to, and we'll have time to discuss. She writes that, and doesn't then move from that stage of her life into, let's take a nap, come on, chocolate drop. Those poems exist at the same time. And I'm just suggesting, I don't know that it's, well, I put that stage of my life behind me. It's that I'm dealing with this constantly, and at the same time I'm dealing with this, I'm also sustaining kind of a spiritual existence, as is indicated, and I love my kids, and we're going to take a nap. I don't know that that's true, but that's the sense I get. I would say, yeah, it's true. The sense I get from all black literature is that there's a balance that's... and that Nigger Can You Kill, that's the title of the poem, is... it's always part of it. And this is always part of it, too. The next thing we're going to read, maybe we'll speak to that a little bit. It's quite long, and I'm not going to read it all. I'm going to skip, so just try to stay with me on that. This is from a book called Best Intentions, or The Education and Killing of Edmund Perry. It's written by Robert Sam Anson, as you see over there, and he's a reporter. He's white, and my sense of reading this book was that he's got some racist attitudes, and you can see those in the book. I was aware of those. I think most of us would see him when he gets into that, but he does a lot of really good research anyway, in spite of that, and I think it's worth reading because when he asks black people to speak, he records word for word what they say. Well, here's one of those good passages from his book. Edmund Perry, this is a true story, and Robert Sam Anson's son went to Phillips Exeter, the great academic academy out east, you know. I mean, I've been there on their campus, and they have two gyms. I mean, they're better outfitted physically than any college. It's a very, very rich place. Rich kids go there. Well, Edmund Perry is black, and he's from Harlem, and he's very, very bright. And he gets a scholarship to Phillips Exeter. And then when he's a junior, headed into his senior year, he's got full ride scholarships to Stanford, to Harvard, to California Berkeley, to the best schools in America. He has got the world by the tail. In the summer between his junior and senior year, back in Harlem, he and one of his buddies decide to roll a guy, you know, rob a guy of $5 on the streets. The guy is white. And the guy is also an undercover cop. And when they get the run, the cop shoots him and kills him. Goes to trial, and that's not the point of this. My point is now, that's the background. Edmund Perry died. And no one can figure out, and that's why he wrote this book. Why? Would a kid who's got it made, Phillips Exeter, Stanford, why does he do this? Here's an interview with a girl who is equally as bright as Edmund Perry, who knew him. On page 90 there, right in the middle where it says you got to understand. And we're just going to skip through it because it's too long. You got to understand how it is for kids like Edmund and me. And again, what we're after is, this is the focus for today, is the difference between this artificial and absolute universe and how schizophrenic it is to live there. You got to understand how it is for kids like Edmund and me. How it is for us to grow up in one environment and then be sent off to school in another that is totally different. You got to understand the kind of things that does to your head. Because if you are like Edmund and you grow up in a place like Harlem, you are taught that you are powerless. Now that's not an absolute. And the illustration I used at the beginning of the hour, Rosa Parks sits in the bus, and that's the woman that in some ways is given credit to initiating the civil rights movement in the 50s. Remember the last story? She wouldn't give up the seat in the bus and gets, okay. In a sense, you are powerful, but it's this. How do you distinguish? When you're 16, how do you distinguish? Okay. You are taught that you are powerless, and deep down you know you are powerless. But still, it's only a vague notion. You talk about the man all the time, but you almost never really see the man. Then you go off to an elite boarding school, and the man is right in front of you. It's one thing to hate something in the abstract, to be aware of some system that is keeping you down. It's quite another to be face to face with that system. You are caught up in a situation where everybody says you should be happy, where you think you should be happy, and instead of being happy, you find there are tears in your eyes because you are so angry. It's all worth reading, but skip to page 93. Edmund has to go home in the summers. The bottom two paragraphs there on page 93, where it says the trouble is. The trouble is, you really aren't a part of that neighborhood anymore. After you see the kind of wealth that Eddie saw at Exeter, or that I saw at my school, you know that there is more to life than hanging out on street corners, having babies, and getting welfare checks. You've been living in an entirely different world. Instead of jiving down on the street corner, you've been getting turned on to Nietzsche and Thoreau. Still, you got to fit in with your friends. How do you do it? I'll tell you how you do it. You got to snort more coke, smoke more reefer, shoot more baskets, and give up more poontang. You've got a week to prove you are black before you're on that bus Monday morning heading back for class. A place like Exeter can't help you make that transition. Exeter is there to teach you mathematics and English and how to be a leader. It doesn't teach you anything about being black. It teaches you just the opposite. It teaches you that you are omnipotent. And for a black kid, that can be dangerous. Because it's one thing to stroll across campus with your head held high, the way leaders are supposed to, and it's quite another to walk down 114th Street that way. You are sending out a totally different signal. What I'm saying is that the kind of behavior that can get you elected student body president at Exeter can get you shot in Harlem. Skip a paragraph. When you go away to one of these schools, though, you are always getting double messages. And what I want us to understand on this, it's more than this girl complaining. And it's more than her just saying, well, we don't fit in. It's a real complex, and I would say even theological issue about the difference here between what's my world and how do I find it? We'll keep going, but be aware of it in that context. You're always getting double messages. One message is, I want you to talk to me and tell me everything that is going on. While the other message is, don't tell me anything that will freak me out because I'll have to deal with it. I'm going to interrupt here and give you one of my favorite quotes in American literature. It's by Richard Wright. Richard Wright says in some of his nonfiction, I have discovered the secret core of race relations in the United States. And that core is this. No one is ever expected to speak honestly about the problem. Think about it. That's what this gal is saying right now. Don't tell me anything that will freak me out, because I'll have to deal with it. Lutheran Church of America, deal with your institutional racism. Wait a minute. And we call it other names and we dance around the issue and don't tell me something that'll freak me out. Okay. You end up being caught between a rock and a hard place. If you go to people and tell them the truth, which is what you're going to bed every night thinking, which is that you are going to bed every night thinking of slashing your wrists, that's bad form. That's embarrassing the school. That's going to cause hard feelings. And if you are black, that is the last thing in the world you want to do. You know that you were there on scholarship, which means that you are there on probation. Scholarships are renewed every year, and you may not be invited back. So you're going to say, so are you going to say anything that will rock the boat? You bet your ass you won't. Basically, black kids aren't supposed to have problems. I see that, and I teach in a Lutheran liberal arts college. It's a great school, and we're doing a lot of, I think, progressive, honest things full of integrity to make us better multicultural and, you know, balance out all the Swedes that are part of our history with all kinds of, you know, a multicultural face on our campus. We're doing a lot of good things. But I see over and over again, and because I teach black literature, I know a lot of black kids pretty well. What are you doing next year? I don't know. Well, you're a really good student. Have you thought about grad school? Well, I'm majoring in social, and nobody's really talked to me about that. Somehow, when it comes to what's going on next year, what kind of grad school are you going to go to? What kind of interviews have you taken? Somehow, often, not always, but often they get missed. Not because we got teachers sitting there saying, I'm going to talk to this white kid and I'm not going to talk to this black kid. I think it's inadvertent, and that's an example of institutionalized racism. And here she's talking about that, I think. I just broadened the context, but listen. Basically, black kids aren't supposed to have problems. And if they do, they aren't supposed to talk about them. I don't have any money for grad school. Well, did you know that this grant is available and you can write here and get this grant? No, I didn't know that. Who tells them? Because black kids aren't supposed to. Instead, they're supposed to be good little niggers, sit there and be grateful. Skip to page, the back, the very back page, 96. The top of 96. Well, the fifth, you know, in the middle of that sentence. Well, maybe Eddie would have had a better time of it if he had gone to a school in Connecticut so he could come home on weekends. Now, this is vision. I'm not saying it's the right solution, but we don't do things anyway, but you go to school for 9 months, and you go home for three, and you come back for nine, and that's, you know, we got this down pat. Maybe Eddie would have been a better time if he had gone to school in Connecticut so he could have come home on weekends. Or maybe he would have done better if he had been in a situation where he could have gone to school 6 months and worked 6 months. Or maybe he would have been fine if he had been in a school that would have allowed him to channel some of his rage into community service. But see, the colleges, and I'm at one, that are good, they're academic. Community service, you know, that's nice, and we'll talk about that. But no, you've got to, I'm sorry, you got to get your calculus done first. We'll do the point is, those questions were never asked. The point is, no one saw outside the box. This is the way it's done. And Eddie ain't rich. Eddie isn't from Boston. Eddie's from Harlem. It didn't work for him. Those questions were never asked. Nobody ever wondered about his individual needs. He was a person who was being used by a whole bunch of people, black and white. So am I surprised at what happened to Edmund? Remember this line and then we'll move on. No, I am not surprised. The only thing that surprises me is that something like this didn't happen sooner. You teach people to be schizophrenic, and they will become schizophrenic. Anybody, any comments or anything? I'm going to skip faster here. What I have with me, and I was going to read parts of it, I'm going to move on, is the Code of Tennessee. And I was going to do this to put this theme in an historical context. I'll read a couple instead of as many as I had planned. These are the laws. These are institutionalized laws of America in the 19th century. Patrols shall have the power to search all Negro houses and suspected places within their respective districts, and to inflict not more than 15 stripes on the bare back of any slave found in such places, or of his owner's plantation in the day or night time, and on it goes. They shall once a month search for guns and other weapons in their respective districts and make return on oath, on it goes. When a runaway slave whose master is unknown is delivered to the jailer, he may, with the consent of the county court or two justices, let him out to hire. I don't know who the slave is, who owns him, but we're going to let him out to hire. There's nothing. This guy, this slave, man or woman, is nobody. On letting out such slave to hire, the jailer, before delivering him to the hirer, shall cause an iron collar to be put on his neck, stamped PG, and then he shall not be answerable for his escape. Ms. Fuller, that's what this whole thing is. The book I Xeroxed was this thick. That's the Tennessee Code. All assemblages of slaves in unusual numbers or at suspicious times or places not expressly authorized by the owners are unlawful. I have two quite close friends at Augustana who are black. whenever I see the two of them talking together and I walk up to them, they say, uh-oh, there's two of us together here. A little conspiracy going on, Paul. You can't join us. They're joking, but they have a sense of this whole thing that says all assemblages of slaves in unusual numbers or suspicious times or places. I challenge the white folks in this room to just walk down the street or into a building and you see five or six black people together. Even if you know two of them well, walk up and say, this is punished by death. And there's a whole list of them. And the last one is robbery, arson, or burglary. Offenses punished by death. Not true for whites. True for blacks. Slave. No slaves. That's history. Those are laws. If we know about the South African situation, that's apartheid. It's slavery. It's legalized discrimination, segregation, apartheid. That's all part of that. Here our artists have responded. Richard Wright, in his autobiography, Black Boy, is very hungry.
Well, I'll just read.
With Aunt Maggie gone, my mother could not earn enough to feed us, and my stomach kept so consistently empty that my head ached most of the day. One afternoon, hunger haunted me so acutely that I decided to try to sell my dog, Betsy, and buy some food. Betsy was a tiny, white, fluffy poodle, and when I had washed, dried, and combed her, she looked like a toy. I tucked her under my arm and went for the first time alone into a white neighborhood where there were wide, clean streets and big white houses. I went from door to door, ringing the bells. Some white people slammed the door in my face. Others told me to come to the rear of the house. But pride would never let me do that. Finally, a young white woman came to the door and smiled. "What do you want?" she asked. "Do you want to buy a pretty dog?" I asked. "Let me see it." She took the dog into her arms and fondled and kissed it. "What's its name?" "Betsy." "She is cute," she said. "What do you want for her?" "A dollar," I said. "Wait a moment," she said. "Let me see if I have a dollar." She took Betsy into the house with her, and I waited on the porch, marveling at the cleanliness, the quietness of the white world. How orderly everything was. Yet I felt out of place. I had no desire to live here. And then I remembered that these houses were the homes in which lived those white people who made Negroes leave their homes and flee into the night. I grew tense. Would someone say that I was a bad nigger and try to kill me here? What was keeping the woman so long? Would she tell other people that a nigger boy had said something wrong to her? Perhaps she was getting a mob. Maybe I ought to leave now and forget about Betsy. My mounting anxieties drowned out my hunger. I wanted to rush back to the safety of the black faces I knew. What do you make of that? History. A little boy. I read in my margins when I first read that. Unreasonable fear. Is it? And why not? Why do we understand that? Historically, what is there in his life that he should trust a white woman, especially in the South?
What happened? Got my curiosity
about it. She came out and she didn't have a dollar. She had 95 cents.
Did she have the dog?
She gave it back to him. She didn't harass him or anything. It's a great ending to that story. It's another, I didn't read that because it's another theme that runs through it. Yeah, she had 95 cents, and he said, "No, ma'am, I want a dollar." She said, "It's almost a dollar. It's a nickel only. I don't have it." "No, ma'am, a dollar." Well, Richard Wright is proud, and there's a whole other thing that sets him up as an artist, I think. It's not unreasonable fear. And somewhere, you tell me, I don't know, and I just have to kind of explore and weigh, and it's real ambiguous. Somewhere between artificial and absolute is the force of history. And when that kid is standing on there, is he going to get a mob? He knows his history real well. He knows it's been done throughout the South at all. But that's not true. But it can be. And you get the point? Is it artificial or is it absolute? And when you're 10, how do you deal with that? And when you're 16, you're Edmund Perry. How do you deal with that?
Well, would you think that would be passed from father, son, mother, daughter? Or would it be something that a young child would experience firsthand?
I think young children seem to carry that instinctually. somehow. That either it's some sort of unspoken messages that they get from adults, which they get all the time, and they're open to that sort of thing. Or a combination of the spoken and the unspoken. But children by a certain age seem to know a lot of that stuff.
But can we make that general?
If you have your kid with you as you go in and you see those five black people and you know two of them, and a child is very aware of you going, I'm not going to talk to those people, even though I know two of them. My daughter's always waiting to see what I'm going to do first, and whether I tug on her hand or what, she gets that signal.
But you have a different kind of question than I see what you're saying. And I have a question to that. Is, you mean then the white kid on the porch would have the same fears?
Mm-hmm. No, because we get different messages.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think what they're saying is that what parents do, some of the, if a parent doesn't say anything, she was saying spoken and unspoken. If a parent shows fear or withdraws or does whatever, the child will pick up on that.
Yeah.
And so in the black family, some of the things that the parents do, they're not spoken, children can kind of perceive or get a feel for things to stay away from or things where you may not be welcome.
But my daughter is always picking up on parts of sentences that we had no idea she was listening to.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes back and tells us things that we had no idea that she knew. And I think the kids will, I can see that this boy by the age of 10 would know all this stuff.
But you're talking about a verbalization. I was thinking that it was more instinctual.
Why? I'm talking about both.
How many times has he been in this white community before?
Never.
Never. Go ahead.
And also, by the 10 years old, was he?
I think he's 6 at this point. Oh, I don't know.
Well, if he's 10 or maybe even 6, he's maybe started school, but he's already started having some sort of a relationship with kids his own age, and there's lots of things that pass between kids that parents don't even have to say.
And if they go downtown for groceries, where do they go? Somehow to the black part of the community, and they walk, maybe, I don't know where it is, but he's never been there before, and with somebody he's had to walk around it or made sure they didn't get in there, and so that's an anxiety. That's one of the that's one of the powerful things about apartheid in South Africa, why it's been so successful.
Maybe
keep them separate. And you can, go ahead.
But was there an explanation of why he chose to sell the dog in the white neighborhood?
Why do you think?
I have money.
Sure. That's where the money is. Sure. That's a good question, and it lifts up, you know, why go there? But his black friend, who is just as hungry, ain't going to buy a dog. Good.
You talk about whites going into a black neighborhood and speaking to someone. But I feel, I was at a place picking up pizza one time, and this black mother of a student of mine came on in and gave me a great big hug in front of all these white people. To me, she's a lot braver than I, although I had another black mother who invited me to her church. And I don't think I didn't go because it was black. I think I didn't go because it was Pentecostal and I wouldn't know how to act.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, Darlene was braver than I was to come up and give me a hug in front of all the whites,
yeah. And what you're pointing out and what this is about too is there's a consciousness there that's always there. Good. Wait in the back, Dave.
Well, he knew about mobs. I mean, I don't think it was just a feeling he had. I think he'd seen it or experienced it I think this was an actual fear born out of an experience, not just something that filtered down.
Yeah. So he's gotten all this body language, and a part of this history. History is not just some abstraction, is it? History is I remember when Ned, if that's one of the in his story, when Ned got caught doing such and such and the mob came. Well, here's another one, also by Richard Wright. This was the first, a little personal testimony here. This was the first black literature I ever read. This story right on the story part of it. And I remember where I was. I was lying on the grass on the beach near the University of Oregon. And I read this story, and I just set it down, and I lay there for an hour, wrestling with all that this story had done to me. And here is one of the episodes in that story that struck me so powerfully. The story opens with a kid named Big Boy, excuse me, and three other friends, and they're about 12 or 13, and I want you to image the 12 and 13-year-old age kids. And we get, for about five pages, they're playing the dozens, and they're going, yeah, your mom wears combat boots, so that's nothing, your mom wears combat boots, and they're dirty, and they keep trying to top each other, and they talk about who's passing gas and fighting wind, and who can swear, and why they're skipping school, and it's too hot, and we don't want to go to school. Anyway, the point of the opening is, they're carefree, and they're little kids, and they're skipping school because it's too hot. And then they come to a no trespassing sign that's right in front of a pond, and they say, should we go swimming or not? Well, it's too hot. I mean, they're kids. So almost as a natural response that these kids in their kind of serendipity, free-for-all way, just boop, plop in and they go swimming. Well, no trespassing means, as they have said at one point, what does no trespassing mean? It means no trespassing for little black boys and dogs. We're going to go? Yeah, we're going to go. They're in that mood, right? I mean, that's kids. Well, while they're swimming, a woman who lives in the house, a white woman, comes down to the hole, the swimming hole. Now these three, four little black kids, one, they're naked. Now they're real little, but they're still males. And she's a white woman in the South. And there's all kinds of implications about the Southern purity and all that kind of stuff that's a part of our Gone with the Wind heritage. The Southern Belle comes down and her chastity and purity and all that is threatened. Well, it's interesting to me, and that's part of what went through my mind that first hour of emotional response to the story. At 12, they already knew about that. They knew that as little black boys, naked, they better not mess with a white woman. Part of this I'm not going to read to you is that after all the action that I am going to read to you, they go back, and I mean, people are killed, and they go back to their mother, and they tell her what happened, and she calls her husband in from the other room, and she says, Saul, it's a white woman. She skipped over the fact that four people have been killed, and Saul, it's a white woman. That whole myth of sexuality that's tied in and purity and all that stuff, well, these that's history. And these kids already know that. Okay, she's down at the edge of the well, or the water hole, and Big Boy's throat felt tight. Lady, we just want to get our clothes, he said. Buck and Lester climbed the embankment and stood indecisively. Big Boy ran toward the tree. Jim! The woman screamed. Jim! Jim! Black and naked, Big Boy stopped 3 feet from her. We want to get our clothes, he said again, his words coming mechanically. He made a motion. You go away! You go away, I tell you! You go away! Big Boy stopped again, afraid. Bobo ran and snatched the clothes. Buck and Lester tried to grab theirs out of his hands. You go away! You go away! The woman screamed. Let's go, said Bobo, running toward the woods. Crack! That's the sound of a rifle. Lester grunted, stiffened, and pitched forward. His forehead struck a toe of the woman's shoes. Bobo stopped, clutching the clothes. Buck whirled. Big Boy stared at Lester, his lips moving. He's got a gun! He's got a gun! Yelled Buck, running wildly. Crack! Buck stopped at the edge of the embankment, his head jerked backward, his body arched stiffly to one side. He toppled headlong, sending up a shower of bright spray to the sunlight. The creek bubbled. Big Boy and Bobo backed away, their eyes fastened fearfully on a white man who was running toward them. He had a rifle and he wore an army officer's uniform. He ran to the woman's side and grabbed her hand. You hurt, Bertha? You hurt? She just stared at him, didn't answer. The man turned quickly. His face was red. He raised the rifle and pointed it at Bobo. Bobo ran back, holding the clothes in front of his chest. Don't shoot me, mister! Don't shoot me! Big Boy lunged for the rifle, grabbing the barrel. You black son of a bitch! Big Boy clung desperately. Let go, you black bastard! The barrel pointed skyward. Crack! The white man, taller and heavier, flung Big Boy to the ground. Bobo dropped the clothes, ran up, and jumped onto the white man's back. You black sons of bitches! The white man released the rifle, jerked Bobo to the ground, and began to batter the naked boy with his fists. Then Big Boy swung, striking the man in the mouth with the barrel. His teeth caved in, and he fell dazed. Bobo was on his feet. Come on, Big Boy, let's go! Breathing hard, the white man got up and faced Big Boy. His lips were trembling, his neck and chin wet with blood. He spoke quietly. Give me that gun, boy. The end of that scene. What do you make of it all? Lots of things are happening there. What do you make of the white guy? This is history. Go ahead.
He just has no sense of value to the lives of you. Just shot. It's nothing. There's nothing wrong with what he just did.
He's killed two little kids.
God.
Because they swam in his pool. That's history. Richard, you go back to the question on the porch. Unreasonable fear? Well, what about... Go ahead.
And not just that, the assumptions he makes. As he's coming up to that scene that's wrapped up in his whole socialization of racism.
Yeah. Very good. And on the basis of those assumptions, he can go ahead and kill two guys. And the Slave Code of Tennessee says if you're guilty of rape was one of those. But these are 12-year-old kids. And then how about this line? He's just killed two kids. He's beaten the tar out of Bobo until finally Big Boy just jumped on his back and had to stop him and got the gun away and knocked him in the teeth. So he's killed two of them, beaten up the other one, and somehow Big Boy gets the gun, and then he says to him, give me that gun, boy. I remember what I wrote in my margin. Assumptions? I mean, that's what you say. In the culturalization of this guy, I can kill the two of you guys and I can beat the tar out of you, and when I say, give me the gun, I expect you to give me the gun.
Well, and he knows what is going to happen to him or not happen to him as a result of any of this.
Right.
He's had the entire history of the white judicial system to show him what's not going to happen.
It's self-defense, isn't it? It isn't. Well, Big Boy runs away. And Big Boy shoots him and kills him. And now there's no hope. And one of the profound, frightening themes in the story is that all institutional supports come down on Big Boy. And, you know, when he goes home and he says to his mother, this is what I've done, and he's crying. I mean, again, he's a little kid. He's crying and he's shook and they know what to do. And, you know, he doesn't have many options. Go tell the sheriff and plead your case. Get a lawyer. You know, take it to court. Go to your church and have him. There are no options. And the option is the title of the story. Big Boy leaves home. One of his uncles comes over and says, there's a train coming through. It's 50 miles north of here, and my brother's coming through with his truck. You stay overnight, you hide till the night. He's coming through in the morning, hop in the truck, and you get out of here. He's 12. He's never going to see mom and dad again. It's gone. It's over. Well, he hides. I mean, that's the only plan for him, and he hides. And they had been playing the day before on the side of a hill where they had dug what he calls kilns, dug holes in this side of the hill.
How about Bobo, too?
Bobo, in the story, he hides in the kiln, and he hears the whites just marauding through the village. Give me a nigger, give me any nigger. You know, they don't care what they get. And they're burning houses and everything else, and they finally catch Bobo, and he watches them burn him at the stake and cut off his fingers. And,
Big Boy watches.
From his kiln. He's hidden. It's not so clear if he sees it. Well, all we get is the language of the people. Hey, I want me a souvenir! And they cut off parts of his body. And if any of you heard that poem the other night on the lynching, that's what happened to Big Boy. Well, here's Big Boy. He stopped at the foot of the kiln, a foot of the hill, trying to choose between two patches of black kilns high above him. He went to the left, where there lay the ones he, Bobo, Lester, and Buck had dug only last week. He looked around again, and the landscape was bare. He climbed the embankment and stood before a row of black pits sinking 4 and 5 feet deep into the earth. He went to the largest and peered in. Now, again, he's 12, or 11, or 13. He's just a kid. He stiffened when his ears caught the sound of a whir. He ran back a few steps and poised on his toe, and 6 foot of snake slid out of the pit and went into coil. Big Boy looked around wildly for a stick. Now, what would you do? Not that hole. No, wait. Okay. But Big Boy knows his history. And you take on that, all the history is, or do you take on this snake? He ran over the slope, peering into the grass. He stumbled over a tree limb. He picked it up and tested it by striking it against the ground. Warily, he crept back up the slope, his stick poised. When about 7 feet from the snake, he stopped and waved the stick. The coil grew tighter, the whir sounded louder, and a flat head reared to strike. He went to the right, and the flat head followed him, the blue-black tongue darting forth. He went to the left, and the flat head followed him there, too. He stopped, teeth clenched. He had to kill the snake, just had to kill him. This was the safest pit on the hillside. He waved the stick again, looking at the snake before, thinking of a mob behind. The flat head reared higher. With stick over shoulder, he jumped in, swinging. The stick sang through the air, catching the snake on the side of the head, sweeping him out of coil. There was a brown, writhing mass, and then Big Boy was on the top of him, pounding blows home, one on top of the other. He fought viciously, his eyes red, his teeth bared in a snarl. He beat till the snake lay still, then he stomped it with his heel, grinding its head into the dirt. Cautiously, he went to the hole and peered, and I won't read anymore, but he crawls into the hole with his imagination going wild. How many more are in there? There aren't any more in there, but the context of fear and history and how it fits in all that. And one last illustration that's both kind of, no, I'll skip it. I'm going to go to something else so you can have a chance to talk. In that context, writers of vision share with us, you know, this is the truth. This is the truth of the black experience in America, and this is the truth of how the white society has responded to and shaped that black experience and the white experience. From "Give me that gun, boy," to the mother, the woman coming out, "Where did that kid go? You know, I got 95 all the questions that the whites are involved in this whole complex differentiation between what's artificial and what's absolute. Lorraine Hansberry, in that wonderful play, Raisin in the Sun, or she's the author of that wonderful play, in another great book by her called To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, talks about the perspective of the self in the context of a history that is so full of oppression and self-denial. In the context of a history that makes a little girl say, "And when I wake up, I'm going to have long blonde hair and blue eyes, and they're going to dazzle at my beauty." In spite of all that, and this is the affirmation, it's the celebration, and it's even the redemption of the self in the face of a history that tries to suppress, but this author and many, many others, and that's why they all write, they won't let it. At this point, Lorraine Hansberry, as young as she is already maybe one of the most famous artists in America, and she's 30 years old only. And she sits alongside on panel discussions with T.S. Eliot, Robert Nib, I mean, big people in literature, and she's there. And critics are always coming up to her and asking her questions, and here's one of them. "Why are you so sure the human race should go on?" one writer asks, as fouled up as we are. I answered him the only way I could. This is Lorraine Hansberry. "That man is unique in the universe, the only creature who has, in fact, the power to transform the universe. Therefore, it did not seem unthinkable to me that women and men might just do what the apes never will, impose the reason for life on life." That's what I said to my friend. "And I wish to live," and at this point, Lorraine Hansberry at 30 is, and she knows it, is dying of cancer. "I wish to live because life has within it that which is good, that which is beautiful, and that which is love. Therefore, since I have known all of these things, I have found them to be reason enough, and I wish to live. Moreover, because this is so, I wish others to live for generations and generations and generations. I was born on the south side of Chicago. I was born black and a female. I was born in a depression after one World War and came into my adolescence during another. While I was still in my teens, the first atom bombs were dropped on human beings at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And by the time I was 23 years old, my government and that of the Soviet Union had entered actively into the worst conflict of nerves in human history, the Cold War. I have lost friends and relatives through cancer, lynching, and war. I have been personally the victim of physical attack, which was the offspring of racial and political hysteria. I have worked with the handicapped and seen the ravages of congenital diseases that we have not yet conquered because we spend our time and ingenuity in far less purposeful wars. I see daily on the streets of New York street gangs and prostitutes and beggars. I know people afflicted with drug addiction and alcoholism and mental illness. I have, like all of you, on 1,000 occasions seen indescribable displays of man's very real inhumanity to man. And I have come to maturity, as we all must, knowing that greed and malice, indifference to human misery, and perhaps above all else, ignorance, that they abound in the world. I say this to you so that you know that one cannot live with sighted eyes and the feeling heart and not know and react to the miseries which afflict this world. I have given you this account so that you know that what I write is not based on the assumption of idyllic possibilities. It's not a phase we've passed out of, and I'm into something else, or of innocent assessments of the true nature of life, but rather my own personal view that I think the human race does command its own destiny, and that that destiny can eventually embrace the stars. All the things, I know all those horrible things, she says, but, and here's Wright at the end of Black Boy, all these things, he's the guy that stood on the porch and tried to sell his dog, and he leaves the South and goes to the North, and he says about that, "So in leaving, I was taking a part of the South to transplant an alien soil." This is a poetic account of his awareness of the artificial and the absolute universe. I'm going to take this culture of the South that's been so absolute to me and plant it somewhere else. And here's the poetry of that. "To transplant it in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom. And if that miracle ever happened, then I would know that there was yet hope in that southern swamp of despair and violence, and that light could emerge." I headed north full of a hazy notion that life, here's the dots, and he's outside these dots, full of a hazy notion that life could be lived with dignity, that the personalities of others should not be violated, that women and men should be able to, I'll just say it the way he does, that men should be able to confront other men without fear or shame, and that if we were lucky in our living on earth, we might win some redeeming meaning for having struggled and suffered here beneath the stars. The world, you tell me, it's kind of redemption, it's kind of affirmation, it's kind of hope, in spite of. We got about 2 minutes on my watch.
Could you just comment and bring us kind of up to date in the situation? Because my feeling is, you know, a lot of these authors were around and they were read and were part of what fueled the civil rights movement. And, you know, there was a very positive feeling that the cause of justice must be acted on, and all sorts of people, you know, did all sorts of things in order to bring about a change situation. And now it seems on campuses, you know, it's kind of like, why would anyone not see that racial injustice was wrong and so forth? And now it seems on campuses, they've almost kind of lost the memory of part of that. It's like rediscovering it again or whatever. What do you see going on in the contemporary campuses with regard to the whole issue?
I've never been much abashed about saying my political leanings. The last two administrations have set back that kind of education on campuses 100 years. And in fact, we can turn the tape off, because who cares about this? I've often argued that Ronald Reagan might be the best president America's ever had, especially with civil rights and the environment, because he's put us in such a state of crisis that we'll respond with final action, and both the environment and that. And that's really visible on the campuses, that there's a whole attitude at the top that suggests, well, we've conquered that, you know. But I would say in the last 3 or 4 years that has changed radically among the students, and that they see all of the rightness and the correctness of the civil rights movement, but they see, yeah, it's right, and, you know, we're not done yet. And I think I'm seeing that on the college campus more and more, that where in the 80s kids thought, we're done, we got it licked, that they don't see that at the end of the 80s. And it goes environment and civil rights, it seemed to me, my general impression, they're going hand to hand, and both are. It's kind of an awakening again to that. So, a Wright who wrote in the 30s and the 40s is still applicable today in the 90s because, well, we don't have separate water fountains and theaters and segregation legalized. You know, the South, we don't have apartheid anymore. But we've got this power, these powerful institutionalized institutions that are, you know, we've got powerful institutionalized racism going on in all our institutions. And I think students say, well, now that's, we have to address that. We have lots of committees at our college that are, you know, what do we do? Is that an answer?
Yeah, right. That's what I was wondering.
So there's a,
where it was moving right now.
Yeah, there's a kind of new relevance to these writers who first write his novels are called protest novels. And they seem to have another kind of relevance that applies to institutional racism in a way that it didn't before. That's a sense that I have. Neil Bell, thank you. Anybody else, we can stay and talk forever. It's more important, your belly or your soul? Don't answer that.